Hello and welcome to Spirited History. I'm Leanne.
And I'm Angela.
We aspire to bring attention to historic sites with a spirited past from around the United States.
Each featured site podcast will include guest interviews, the history of the featured site, paranormal evidence, and links to the featured site.
Some podcasts will also include the following segments: Batgirl's Cave of Paranormal Delights and tidbits from Lodima's Lair.
So please join us as we journey through spirited history.
And welcome to Spirited History. I'm Leanne.
And I'm Angela. And it's Friday.
And we are delighted that you are tuned in to Spirited History here on the Para-X Radio Network. Tonight, we are welcoming back to Spirited History one of our favorite guests, Chris Sepner, who is a visual artist and curator of the Edgar Allan Poe Museum in Richmond, Virginia. And he's also written several books about the museum and Mr. Poe himself. Now, folks, so many supernatural, disastrous, and spiritual occurrences happened during Edgar Allan Poe's life that may have influenced his written works. Tonight, we will be exploring Chris's new book, Haunting Poe, His Afterlife in Richmond and Beyond. Please welcome Chris Sepner to Spirited History.
Hello.
So wonderful to have you back. You're just one of our favorite guests. You always have amazing stories to tell us.
Well, it's always intriguing, too, because we get these wonderful little golden nuggets of information and unusual tales that are associated with the museum and Mr. Poe himself. And this book is full of just incredible occurrences that are kind of paralleling his life. And also you kind of can start to see how this web of the mysterious and the unusual is just kind of swirling around him. And I just can't wait to delve into the book. So we're just going to go ahead and start right now. Ange, you want to take the first question?
Well, yeah. During your research for this book, what were some of the supernatural stories or experiences that Edgar Allan Poe might have been exposed to in his early life that could have influenced his literary works?
What really occurred to me was the Great Richmond Theater Fire of 1811, and there's all sorts of stories associated with it. And even before the fire took place, people were saying that there were omens or signs in the stars. And it really reminds you that in Poe's day, people were really looking at the signs. They were trying to read the signs and find out what the stars are telling us. And that's a recurring theme throughout Poe's works. Always, when you're reading his poetry or stories, look to the stars. If he describes the constellations, there's probably a reason why he's describing this particular star, that particular constellation. It tells you what time of year it is. It also might foreshadow what's going on in that work. Well, the theater fire, this is Richmond, 1811. The city only had about 10,000 people there. The Richmond Theater was the largest theater in town, and it was the night after Christmas. And everybody who was anybody was going to go to the theater to see the new play, The Bleeding Nun. It was a comedy. Back then, that's their sense of humor, I guess. So they thought Bleeding Nuns was funny. And they crammed 600 people into what today would look like a big wooden shed. But they were stuffed in there. And fire codes weren't quite what they are today. To get up to the balconies, the really expensive seats, you took this rickety wooden staircase. And the balconies, I'm surprised, even held up under the weight of all the people on them. They're just held up by wooden columns. And even before the play, I told you people were seeing signs that something was going on. So not just people who said there's something in the air, there's a comet, there's a shooting star. But also there's one guy, James Gibbon, who is a naval hero. This is a guy, and he'd seen combat. He'd been a prisoner of war. I mean, this guy was not afraid of anything.
Right.
Except going to theater that night.
Huh.
He'd had a dream that he'd gone into a big empty room and he'd seen the most terrifying face he could possibly imagine. He knew this was a sign. He should absolutely not go to the theater that night. Of course, his girlfriend, Sally Conyers, she was like, I have to go to the theater. You got to go. I mean, we got to be seen together. And he says, he begged her not to go. And finally, you know, she talked him into going. But while he was watching the play, he saw that face on the stage. One of the actors had the face he'd seen in that dream. So he just took off. He just said, you know, I'm going to take off. And he made it across the street, started heading down the hill to the Virginia State Capitol when he heard behind him screams. And he realized that the theater was on fire. He'd escaped just in time, but Sally hadn't. So he ran back into the theater. Unfortunately, he didn't make it back out again. They found what was left of them. They only identified them by his uniform. His naval uniform had the big buttons on it. So they recognized him by that. They recognized her by her jewelry. But that was about it, because a lot of the people were just burnt to a crisp. The governor, they described as a crisp heap.
Yes.
So imagine just a crispy heap of governor there. And what had happened was a chandelier backstage, all lit by candles. Apparently, one or two of the candles hadn't been blown out. So they were trying to lower the chandelier so they could blow out the candles. And the rope got stuck, so it started yanking on the rope and then swung the chandelier. And the candles bumped into one of the backdrops made of canvas covered with oil paint. And that started lighting up. And before you know it, that spread to the wooden beams and the ceiling, and the roof was on fire. And if you can imagine this, I described it as like a big wooden shed, but it had over the door at one of the gable ends was a big round window. And they said, people, witnesses said, fire was shooting at that round window. It looked almost like a giant dragon. Imagine this, December, the middle of the night, sitting on top of this hill, this big fire-breathing dragon just shooting out flames. This wasn't the only story. There are lots of stories like this from that time period, stories that Poe, as a kid, would have grown up with. There's one, there's a girl named Nancy Green, and there's different versions of this. I think that's a lot of these stories where there's different versions of them. One is that she had a dream, another one that, that she was walking from her house into the city, and she passed a little ravine, and a strange ghostly figure said, Nancy Green, Nancy Green, you won't live to be 16. Or, the other thing is all the different stories about it, whether she's actually saw a ghost or she had a dream, they all had that same little rhyme that she wouldn't live to be 16. And sure enough, she died in that theater fire like a day before her birthday.
Oh, wow.
And these are people that ran in Poe's crowd. I told you the city only had about 10,000 people. A lot of the people knew each other. And a lot of the people were people who knew Poe's foster parents. He had just been orphaned in Richmond that same month. He was taken in by John and Frances Allen. And the only reason they weren't in the fire, they were theater goers, but they were out of town visiting relatives for Christmas, and that's why they missed it. But the woman, Jane Scott McKenzie, who at the same time, you know, Poe and his sister were orphaned, but she took in Poe's sister, and she was planning on going to the theater that night too, but I think Poe's sister got sick and she had to stay home and take care of her, or else she would have been in the fire. She would have been sitting in the same box as Sally Conyers. Fortunately, she got to stay home, but you can imagine what's in the air there. People are saying, do you remember that theater fire? And here's Poe growing up. They decided that that ground was cursed and should never build another theater on that spot. 72 people had died.
Which is a lot back then.
One body from the next. They decided, well, what we should do is build a church, make this sacred ground. And they built a church on the site of that theater. And the remains of the victims are underneath the church in a little dirt floored crypt down there that you can sometimes visit. If you get permission, you can go visit the crypt. The Allens, who had just taken in Poe, they were founding members. They owned pew number 80. So Poe used to worship in the church where that fire had taken place. And all around him, the church wasn't just a normal church. It was decorative scenes of mourning and death. So wherever you look, there were upturned torches. You know, upturned torch means you're putting out the light on the torch, or there's other signs of death and dying all around you. And what kind of role did this play in Poe growing up? And he's already growing up at an age when people were attuned to the supernatural, attuned to omens and to signs. And now he's surrounded by this presence of death and the fragility of life. So you can just imagine what that could have played, what kind of role that could have played in his works. And we at the museum, we always like to think, well, maybe this played a part in inspiring the Conqueror Worm. That's one of his poems where he describes the play as the tragedy man, the hero, the conqueror worm. He describes this play where everybody's in a theater to see a play of hopes and fears while the orchestra beats fitfully the music of the spheres, mimes in the form of God on high, mutter and mumble low, and hither and thither fly, mere puppets they who come and go at bidding of vast formless things that shift the scenery to and fro, flapping from out their condor wings invisible woe. And so everybody's watching the play, and much of madness and more of sin and horror, the soul of the plot. But see amid the mimic rout, crawling shape intrude, a blood-red thing that writhes from out that scenic solitude. It writhes and writhes with mortal pangs. The mimes become its food, and seraphs sob and vermin fangs in human gore imbued. Out, out are the lights out all, and o'er its quivering form, the curtain of funeral pall comes down with a rush of a storm, while the angels all pallid and wan, uprising and veiling affirm that the play is the tragedy man, and its hero the conqueror worm. Just imagine the imagery of that. I mean,
yeah.
The lights coming down, the curtain falling.
Yes.
The red maybe withering that, could be the yeah, fire.
That, yeah. I mean, just what kind of impressions that make on the young boy who's grown up, you know, hearing the stories, worshiping on that spot every week, returning to that spot where this has happened.
Right.
And knowing that his mother was an actress who used to perform in that theater.
Yes.
There's all these great connections. And Poe also was exposed to the supernatural through the African-American community. His foster father had slaves, but there are also freemen with whom Poe associated with. And the Allen family servants used to spend a lot of time with Poe. He spent time with them. He always felt like kind of an outsider in Richmond High Society where everybody's related. You know, everybody's connected to everybody else.
Oh, yeah.
The Randolphs are related to the Lees and the Jeffersons and the Marshalls. And here's Poe, this orphan. He's not of the Virginia aristocracy. He's an actress's kid, the lowest of the low.
Right.
They thought of actresses as not much more than prostitutes. And here he is, this kid growing up in the home of a merchant.
Mm-hmm.
And merchants were a little bit lower level than these planters who'd been here for generations and generations. So Poe felt like an outsider, but he seemed to really feel at home with the servants and with the blacks. And he heard their stories and learned about their customs. And one of them, for instance, is called the Walking Boy. And there's something called conjuring where they tried to manipulate the elements to find treasures or to put hexes on people. But one way to find a buried treasure, somebody's hidden their treasure, you could put a beetle in a bottle and tie a string to the bottle. And whichever way the beetle in the bottle walks, you would pull the string in that direction. And the beetle would lead you to the treasure. I couldn't help but be reminded of Poe's story, The Gold Bug. There was an African-American freedman who tied a beetle, tried a little string around a gold beetle, and to find a buried treasure, he lowered it through the eye of a skull. So you imagine, yeah, maybe Poe is hearing some of these customs and hearing some of these religious traditions and incorporating this kind of mysticism into his works. And that's something I got interested in trying to track down because you don't have a whole lot of written records of this. Edmund Ruffin in the 1840s had gone to Charleston, written about some of the customs of haunts and conjuring. But we don't have a lot of written records of these until maybe the Great Depression. You get a lot more written records of this as people recording the oral traditions. It's really interesting to find out, well, how are these inspiring Poe stories? What is this tradition that maybe has been overlooked, but has been playing a great role in his works?
Well, he was just growing up in such an explosive time of great thinkers and science and industry, and we're getting into some of the more supernatural aspects of mesmerizing and spiritualist movement. And there were many women that came in and out of his life. And there was one in particular that really struck his fancy, and that was Jane Stannard. How did her death affect Poe and his writing? Well, what did it kind of lead him on a journey to?
and
that's Max.
Hello, Maxie.
Hi, Max.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, this is Poe as a teenager. He was 14 when he met her, fell head over heels for her. but she was his best friend's mother. Wouldn't have really worked out. He was still a kid, but he liked to worship her from afar because, you know, he's a poet. It's more romantic to worship from afar and to write poetry. And she gave him motherly advice and encouragement throughout. Probably thought he was a nice, weird kid. But he sort of described her as one of the really bright spots in his otherwise dark childhood. You know, she gave him the encouragement he needed at a time when his foster father was telling him not to waste his time reading poetry, not even to entertain the idea of becoming a poet. Who makes a living as a poet? Even back then, that wasn't really a career option. But she was there for him, and she provided him that support. But then she went insane and died. Just suddenly she was taken away from him. It said he maybe saw her once while she was ill, and then she was gone, just like that. And he kept a vigil at her grave for night after night. And, you know, her son was there, and her son would wait, but then her son stopped showing up. Poe kept going night after night. And why did he keep going back there? You know, they had perfected the art of mourning in Poe's day. They knew how to mourn. They knew the rituals of it. But even for that time, even when a time when, you know, a woman might dress in black for a whole year, wear a veil over her face, collect all of her tears in a tear catcher. Even for that time period, Poe was going a little bit overboard in the morning. And other people were noticing, why does he keep going back to her grave at night? Is he trying to commune with her? Does he somehow think that maybe she's going to come back? And you see in his works that same kind of devotion to someone who's lost. Think about, for instance, Eleonora. Eleonora passes away and she's still there. Her presence is still there. And her husband lives with that feeling that she's still there. And she forbids him to ever fall in love again. And he's afraid to fall in love because he knows she won't approve. For Lygia. Lygia is a good example of this woman who says that we only succumb to death through weakness of our will. If we can just have strong enough willpower, we can overcome death. And she passes away because that's the whole point of the story. But she finds a way to come back by possessing the body of her husband's second wife, just taking it over. And you see this theme again, Morella, but they're just women who don't seem to stay dead. That somehow, that even though they're dead and entombed, they find their way to come back. And even if we look at the Raven, he's lost his Lenore, the narrator. He wants to reunite with Lenore. He begs the Raven to tell him, tell this soul with sorrow laden, if within the distant Aden it shall clasp the sainted maiden whom the angels name Lenore. And we know what the Raven says, because it only says one thing, nevermore. But the man, he's so driven insane by grief, he imagines that he can smell some censers swung by seraphim who are walking along the tufted floor, and her footsteps tinkle on tufted floor. He imagines that maybe she is there, just out of sight. He can't see her. He can't really hear her, but he can smell those unseen censers. So there's that strong urge to reconnect with somebody who's passed. I think one of Poe's biographers, James Harrison, this is the turn of the century. He says that the young Poe, the reason he stayed there by James Sanders' grave all those nights was that Poe was filled with a passionate feeling of undying companionship, even with the dead, which afterwards ran like a line of fire through his romances of death, trance, and sentience after death. Maybe just had this strong urge. Maybe he could tell himself it's, you know, it's impossible. It can't really happen, but somehow I can reunite with this lost loved one. And by this time, even as a teenager, let's look at Poe's track record. He's lost both of his parents. His mother died a month before her third birthday. He never knew her. He never knew his father. Now he's fallen in love with this woman, and she's taken away from him, too. And he doesn't know it yet, but in 5 years, his foster mother's going to die. She's going to be taken away. Then he's going to get married, and his wife has only lived to be 24. Wow. So it's a theme throughout his life that when he really falls in love with them, gets really connected with somebody, and really depends on them, that they're taken from him. This can be a pretty depressing interview, but
part of me is like the romance in that of being so emotionally connected to someone and just that aspect of even in death, that connection still being there for him. I can't help but think, yes, this is a reoccurring theme. And is he trying to work it out so that they are reconnected, or he is with Jane?
Yeah.
And part of me admired him. I was like, he likes older women. All right.
And it does remind me of, let's say, Harry Houdini. The reason he got so interested in spiritualism and debunking fake spiritualists was because he wanted to reconnect with his mother. He wanted to be able to see her again, to speak with her again, to know that she's still out there. So maybe it's Poe really wanting to know that these people he loved are still out there and that he can be reunited with them. Maybe that's what got him interested in the experiments that people were performing with mesmerism and spiritualism. Also, it was in the air. People around him were experimenting with mesmerism, which was not exactly new, but it really taken off a fellow, Franz Anton Mesmer. So it's named after him. It's similar to hypnotism. It's based on the idea of animal magnetism, that all animals and even inanimate objects have magnetic currents running through them. And if you can control those magnetic currents, you can make a chicken lay eggs. You can make a cow produce more milk. You can control a person's mind. And people were using mesmerism for healing. And one surgeon at this time actually tried to mesmerize his patients so they wouldn't feel any pain during surgery, which is saying a lot because they didn't have a lot of modern anesthesia back then. So you really needed something to kill the pain. And it's really taken off in popularity during Poe's day. And one thing that Poe writes about that turns up again and again is this idea that maybe when somebody's mesmerized, their spirit is free of their body. Since you're free of your body, you're just a spirit walking around. You can see other spirits and you can contact those spirits all around you. There was a mesmerist named Andrew Jackson Davis, who's very popular this time. He'd go on stage, go into a trance, and while he's in the trance, he'd talk to spirits. And these spirits could tell you things. They could tell you what it's like on the other side. And people would crowd auditoriums to hear Andrew Jackson Davis talk about the summer land, this other side, this world where there's equality for everyone, where it's always summer. It's just this perfect world on the other side. He would talk to spirits, say, from other times, to Galen and Emanuel Swedenborg, these people who'd passed centuries earlier. And people were very fascinated with this. So Poe started writing stories about mesmerism. And one of them is Mesmeric Revelation, which is told almost like it's a transcript of a guy, a scientist, who's just mesmerized a man just before his death. And he's asking questions about what's the nature of the universe? What is God? What is spirit? And there's another good one, The Facts in the Case of M. Valdemar, which appeared in American Review. And it's the account of a man named Valdemar who's dying. He knows he's dying, wasting away. And the mesmerist has asked him, now, before you die, can I mesmerize you? And finally, Valdemar says, I'm about to die, so come on down. I'm not going to last another day. So the mesmerist come there, and they put the man into a trance. But while he's in a trance, he dies. He passes over while in a trance. And they've never seen something like that before because he's in a trance state, so his spirit's already left the body, but now he's dead, so he's sort of half in and half out of life. And they keep him in this trance state for months and months, and they'll ask him, what do you see over there? What's it like on the other side? And are you still with us? And the body is starting to decay. His tongue becomes a swollen black mass, and it's really obvious just from looking at him, he's dead. And finally, Valdemar says, wake me, I can't live like this anymore, put me out of my misery. So they wake him up from his trance, and he just dissolves into a pool of goo before their very eyes.
Oh, God.
A mass of loathsome, of detestable putrescence.
Oh, and I love that word.
Appeared, and people thought it was a true story. They kept reprinting it. It got reprinted in the Popular Record of Modern Science. It got reprinted on both sides of the Atlantic in medical journals. Even at the Poe Museum, we have a little pamphlet printed in London. Just a couple months after it was first printed in America, it's printed over in London as a true story.
And gosh, I love it.
Mesmerist started writing to Poe saying, this is true, isn't it? This is really true. It's not a hoax, right? And before you know it, there's controversy because some people are saying, how could you possibly believe a story like this? And And Poe just laughed. He had a good time just imagining people really were believing this story was not only possible, but true. And one mesmerist actually wrote to Poe and said that he had attempted to replicate the experiment on one of his patients who died from drinking too much and was able to bring him back from the dead. So he probably just passed out from drinking too much and he revived him. But
right.
And see, that's it was hilarious. In the air. People, you know, mesmerism was the hot new science, and they all wanted to learn how they could use it to heal the mind and body and maybe, just maybe, conquer death. About this time, Andrew Jackson Davis was in one of his trance states, and this was March of 1848, and he says that the world has just changed. Something huge has just happened. It's going to change the world. And I don't know what happened, how he knew it, but at the same time, these girls, they were just young girls, just maybe about 10, 13 years old. They were the Fox sisters, and they lived up in Hinesville, New York, and they started hearing knocking noises, which they said were coming from the spirit of a dead peddler, and that they could communicate with him. They would say, ask him questions, so many knocks for yes, so many knocks for no. People started coming to them and trying to communicate with the other side using this knocking technique. And that's considered the birth of the modern spiritualist movement, even though Andrew Jackson Davis and other people were already performing experiments. It's really the Fox sisters that really took off. So Andrew Jackson Davis is maybe MySpace, but the Fox sisters are Facebook. So that's the one everybody knows. Mm-hmm. That's the one everybody gets involved with.
Right.
And Davis is considered more of the St. Paul of spiritualism because he's the one who wrote down the teachings and codified it. He came up with the terminology, like Summerland and everything. Whereas the Fox sisters, the ones who really got noticed and really popularized the movement, which really outgrew them, you know, went around the world. But Poe is right there at the beginning. And people he knew were really involved with spiritualism. One of them was Sarah Helen Whitman. Now, this is after Poe's wife's death, had really fallen apart after that. And it was Whitman who started, you know, getting Poe's attention. She sent him a love poem. They never met. He says later that he saw her from a distance once in her garden, tending the garden at night, wearing a long white dress. That's what you do. You go out and plant in the garden in the middle of the night, right?
In a white. Yeah.
In a white dress.
The white dress.
So she wrote him this poem to Edgar A. Poe about how she wanted to fly away with the raven to his nest up in the sky. So he dropped everything, went up to Providence to meet her. And when he got to Providence, it took him to the most beautiful spot in all of Providence, the local cemetery. While she was there, she lay down amongst the graves and said, this is the grave of someone I loved. And Poe said, oh, this is the perfect woman for me. Let me tell you about, I'll tell you all about Jane Stannard. I used to hang out at her grave. And before you know it, they had a lot in common. And he thought that maybe, just maybe, she was somehow Jane Stannard's spirit to come back to life through her. Maybe, I don't know how the math works on that, because she was actually too old. She was born while Jane Stannard was still alive.
Yeah.
Right.
But okay. Apparently her spirit was occupying the body. And he also told her that they were somehow soulmates. They're both born on January 19th, different years, but the same day. So that was a sign, another sign. You always have to look for signs and symbols. He also rearranged the spellings of their names to find out if there's any connection. He really was interested in trying to woo her by appealing to her interest in the supernatural and the mystical. And after he died, she said that she was still in contact with him. And she really went out of her way to try to stay in contact. She became a medium herself.
Huh.
And when I say the word medium, a lot of your listeners already know what a medium is. But basically, it's the medium of communication between this world and the next, kind of like a radio is, I don't know if anybody still uses radios, but it's a medium of communication. It conveys the message from the radio station to the listener. So she's like, they call it a spiritual telegraph. So she's just the telegraph conveying these messages from the other side.
Poe was actually very feisty, apparently. How many people did he challenge to a duel in his life?
Only three? Dueling in Virginia was all the rage, and it was really illegal, In the North, it had kind of died out after the Hamilton Bird duel.
Right, Hamilton and Bird.
It sort of died out in popularity. But in the South, it continued in Richmond. It continued up until the 1880s. So nearly 40 years after Poe's death, it was still going on. There were actually dueling grounds at the east end of Richmond. You could still sort of drive down to the spot where the dueling grounds were. There are houses around there now. I'm just going to imagine these people in these houses have no idea of how many people were shooting at each other back in the day. Maybe even some people died right there in their front yard and they don't even know about it. Right sort of on Churchill, think about 30th Street. Think about 30th and Franklin Street. There's old dueling fields that don't look like anything now. It just looks like, oh, you're going down a hill.
Funny.
But when Poe was around, one of them was a fellow, he's the brother of, this was I believe Elizabeth Ellet, and she had been sending Poe flirtatious letters, you know.
Ooh.
She was sending him a business letter on one side of the paper. On the back, she'd write in German, meet me at my apartment tonight. And then the next letter, she'd write in German, why didn't you meet me at my apartment tonight? So Elizabeth Ellet started to get offended. Why isn't he responding? Does he not know German?
Right.
But it turns out Poe was also exchanging sort of flirtatious poems with this other poet named Frances Osgood. So when Elizabeth Ellet got wind of that, she was a little bit jealous. So she started spreading a rumor that she'd seen a letter from Frances Osgood to Poe lying open on a table in his house. She didn't explain why she was reading somebody else's letters. But she said there was something that was so terrible. I can't tell you what it is, but it was awful. And she implied that maybe they'd have a love child together or something. But she didn't want to say it. She didn't want to go on record saying anything.
Right.
And before you know it, a group of ladies showed up at Poe's house and demanded that he return all of Frances Osgood's love letters to him. And, of course, Poe, being Poe, said, well, Mrs. Ellet should worry about all things she's been sending me.
Oh.
And now Ellet was busted, and she sent her brother to Poe's house to have him retract the statement, said, you're a liar. My sister would never send you a love letter. You better retract it. And Poe said, you can't call me a liar. I challenge you. So then Poe went to another friend to get a pistol, because you had to have a certain kind of pistol to have the duel, one that was sort of a smooth barrel, so it wasn't really a good shot. But he got into a fight with that other guy, never got the pistols, never had the duel. Another time was in Richmond. There was a magazine editor named John Moncure Daniel who had been talking smack about Poe. So Poe just showed up at his office one day with a pistol and said, I challenge you. And Daniel said, why don't you sit down and have a drink instead? And they sat down to have a drink, and it worked out. And I think it was probably Daniel's fault, because he got into about 8 duels in his lifetime.
Oh, wow.
And usually with a duel, nobody really got hurt. I think there were only about 20% of them somebody actually died. A lot of times your second could negotiate some kind of truce or something.
Right.
End up dying of tuberculosis. So after all those duels, tuberculosis got him.
Poe, speaking of illnesses, Poe had quite a relationship with cholera that brought about a really frightening encounter for him. Can you tell our listeners about this horrific experience that he had?
Well, in 1849, cholera was having a really bad outbreak. It had first really come to the United States in force in 1832. So this was while Poe was in Baltimore, and he got to see death on a massive scale like he hadn't really experienced before. They didn't know where cholera really came from, what caused it. Some of the big broadsides they were posting was saying that it was caused by sinful living.
Oh, God.
And by all these people drinking alcohol, you should avoid alcohol and drink more water.
Oh, God,
now no, no.
Back and say, oh, no, that's the worst thing. You shouldn't be drinking the water. But when he's in Philadelphia, he told an editor at the Southern Literary Messenger in Richmond. So after Philadelphia, he came to Richmond and told John Daniels about what he'd seen there. He says he was eerie. The sunlight was so bright. The sky was so clear and blue. But there was desolation everywhere around him. In those days, there weren't a lot of cures for cholera. You got such horrible diarrhea that you become dehydrated. You could die within a day. It was an awful, gruesome way to die. And one cure that cured everything, cured your cholera, your yellow fever, your tuberculosis. It was called Calomel. So pop some of these pills, and just keep taking until your gums start bleeding and you know you've had enough. But now he's like, oh, the calomel, that's made of mercury. You probably shouldn't be ingesting mercury pills.
No. Oh my God.
But that was one of the cures they had. The other good cure they had was running. Just go. Just get as far as you possibly can.
Just run.
If you can afford to leave, leave. So
that was probably the best
New York City that summer. Yeah, they said that out of a population of about 300,000 people, 100,000 left New York City that summer. Just got out.
Yeah.
If you have anywhere else to be, just go there and wait it out until it's over. So in Philadelphia, a lot of people were gone. A lot of the people that he knew, they'd already taken off to hide out in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And he could see the carriages riding up and down the street collecting bodies, taking those out to the edge of town for mass burials. And then something happened to him. Either he had too much to drink, but he'd contracted the cholera. And he complains that he was having spasms and the cholera quite bad. But he also complains he didn't know which was worse, the calomel pills the doctor had given him or the cholera. And he was thrown into jail, apparently for public drunkenness, although he says in his letter, I wasn't drunk, it was about Virginia. Maybe he's weeping about Virginia. And that's when it gets weird.
Okay.
That's when it gets weird. It wasn't weird before.
Yeah, he said that he was in the jail and he saw this shining figure. And it was so bright, he was looking out his windows and it cast a shadow of the bars across his cell. According to one account, he told one fellow, John Sartain, who was another Philadelphia guy, told him that it had spoken to him some truths, but when John Sartain wrote these things down, he'd forgotten exactly what the spirit had told Poe.
Hmm.
Would you think it'd be the one thing you'd really want to remember, the most important part of the story is what it had told him? According to another guy, John Thompson, who Poe told about this once he got back to Richmond, the figure had taken him up out of the cell and into the sky, and once he was in the sky, it turned into a big black bird and started croaking, I am the cholera. And they looked down at all the desolation far, far below them. And somehow Poe felt that he was the cause of all this death and despair all around him. And then the next day Poe said, well, it was all hallucination. It wasn't real. So we don't know what this is. There was some spiritualist. His name was John Wooster Robertson. He believed that this is all actually Poe having an encounter with a spirit. So we don't know what this is. Poe is saying that, well, it was hallucination. I don't know what was going on. Poe had to sort of be talked down the next couple of days by his friend John Sartain, who was saying, well, you know this isn't real, right? You know, there's something that this is all just a dream.
Right, a hallucination.
But, and the weirdest thing was that Poe told Sartain that he'd seen these people who wanted him to drink boiling oil, and he refused to drink it. So then right before his eyes, they pulled out his mother-in-law, so his first wife's mother,
right,
and they cut off her feet, and then they started to cut off her legs, and they started cutting off her knees and going up and up her body, cutting pieces off, and he just horrified this. And there's actually a letter he wrote to her saying, I was horrified at what I thought they'd done to you. I was horrified that this dread that you were dead. And so apparently he was concerned enough about it that he wrote to her just to make sure she's okay, that this
right.
wasn't some kind of presentment.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, John Sartain, you know, had to be the voice of reason saying, why would they be doing this to you? I mean, this doesn't make any sense. Who hates you enough to torture you like this? So Poe realized, oh yeah, maybe that didn't really happen. Maybe it's just a dream, either from fever or from
mercury,
a bad drink,
poisoning.
From the mercury poisoning.
Some delirium, right?
Yeah.
But it had to have been real enough for him, like you said.
Oh, yeah.
To put pen to paper and to see if his mother-in-law was all right.
Right.
We don't know what this might have been inspired in Poe. Maybe this would have worked its way into some of his works if he lived longer, but he didn't realize it, but he only had about 3 more months to live. Although, maybe he did realize that the end was near, because it's something about Poe. He thought he was at the end. Something told him that the end was near. He told his mother-in-law that he had this feeling he'd never see her again. When he left on his tour that was taking him down to Richmond, he had no reason to believe this. He's 40 years old. He seems to be in good health, but he told her, I think I'll never see you again. And she was a little bit disturbed by this, but that's kind of the way Poe thought. He just felt like the end was near. One of his friends, her name was Annie Richmond, he made her, this is when he was 39 years old.
Mm-hmm.
A year earlier, he said, make a promise to me, just that you're going to be with me when I die. I don't know who talks like that I'm sending you love poems and I'm confiding in you. I just want you to be with me when I die. So he had that feeling that death was near.
Right.
And then he was in Richmond as he was leaving at one of his friends' houses. They saw him right behind him, a shooting star shot over above his head. They thought, oh, this is another sign that his death is near. But something made him have this presentiment that death was near, but I'm not sure exactly what it was. I mean, he still kept playing for the future. He was trying to find financial backers to start his own magazine, but in the back of his head, there was that feeling that time is running out.
Well, can you go through the sequence of events that kind of involved Poe's last reading of The Raven at the home of Susan Archer Talley and his journey to Baltimore that ended in his tragic death?
Well, Susan Archer Talley was the friend of Poe's sister, Rosalie Poe. She lived with her foster family at Duncan Lodge in the western outskirts of Richmond. And Duncan Lodge's closest neighbor was Talavera, where Susan Archer Talley lived. And she was a poet. So she'd been reading Poe's work. She'd actually had some of her work published in the Female Poets of America. So back then, the Poets and Poetry of America, that book was all males. So they had a special book just for the female poets, but she had made it into that book, and Poe praised her poetry. You know, she's sort of starting out. Of course, Poe, he's the famous guy. He's Edgar the Raven Poe, so she couldn't wait to hear more about it and to meet him and to get advice about poetry and about how he'd written The Raven. She said that he told her that The Raven really started as an owl, but then I thought The Raven would be better than an owl. Just little tips like that. And she was hard of hearing, so we think that maybe she was reading his lips a little bit, or maybe she just had to get really close, or maybe put a horn up to her ear to get a better hear for this. But she wanted to hear him read his poetry, and Poe would give private readings at different homes of friends. He made money by giving public readings on stage, but he would give these private readings of The Raven. He turned down the lights real low. So at her house, a few people were gathered, his sister and Susan Talley and her family, and the kids and the servants were waiting outside the room. It was sort of a parlor. And I visited the room, so it's just a little parlor with a hallway outside. His voice got really low, and he started out, "Once upon a midnight dreary," and they all gathered around him solemnly. And then we got to the part at the end, "Get thee back into the tempest, the night's plutonium shore." And they could hear all the kids in the hallway outside just run, take it off. But then he finally calms down and says, "My soul from out that shadow that lies floating in the floor shall be lifted nevermore." And then he sat down in his chair, and his sister just hopped in his lap. And maybe that was her idea of a joke. I mean, but he said, "Oh, I should bring her all my readings. She could play the part of the Raven."
Touché.
So just sort of the lighter side of Poe, you know, just enjoying a poetry reading with friends. And that was the night when he left and said behind him there's a shooting star, and they had a presentiment that maybe he would never return. The next day, he dropped off one of his poems over the Southern Literary Messenger to repay a guy for a loan. He gave him a copy of Annabel Lee. Then he visited Elmira Shelton, his fiancée, at her house on Churchill. So if you're not from Richmond, Churchill is on the eastern outskirts of town, and he'd come all the way from the western outskirts of town. So this is quite a ways away. And leaving her, he was going to go to Rocket's Landing, which again, on the eastern end of town, that was where he would take the steamship up to Baltimore, where he had to train to Philadelphia, then from Philadelphia, another train to New York. So after he left Elmira's house that evening, there's no way he's going all the way to the west end of the town. He stopped by a friend, John Carter, who was a doctor, who said, "Well, Poe, you're not looking so good." And Elmira even commented, "He's not looking so good. He's kind of got a fever. His pulse is weak." And she advised him, "Please don't travel tomorrow. You'll never make it back. You're too sick. You just stay here a few more days. You don't need to be in such a hurry." And Poe said, "No, I've got to do this. I've got an editing assignment in Philadelphia. Then I've got to go to New York and get my old mother-in-law, bring her back down here to Richmond. So she'll be able to live with us at Elmira's house." And all these plans going on. And he says, "I have to get married. I have to get married right away." So he was really insistent with Elmira that they get married and married right away. That he says that love that hesitates is not love at all. "You've got to make this commitment to me." He even got her a ring. He was in a hurry, but he left her house and stopped by Carter's house. And even at Carter's house, he he ducked out of there, says, I'm going to step over Sadler's, get a bite to eat. And he just left. But he took Carter's walking stick with him. We don't know why he took it. It was a Malacca sword cane, and left his own walking stick there. And then they say he stayed at Sadler's restaurant till about midnight. The steamship was coming in at 4:30 in the morning, so there's no way he's going to get all the way back to the West End and then come back to the East End. So he just left Sadler's and walked down to Rocket's Landing, and he caught the early morning steamship. And then we got to Baltimore about 2 days later. He was supposed to catch a train that would take him to Philadelphia. And we don't know if he caught the train or not. We know some of his luggage was at the train depot, so he was planning on catching the train. One story, it was raining when Poe's there, but the train tracks didn't go all the way to Philadelphia. They got to a river. They'd get off the train, take a ferry to the other side, and then catch another train on the other side. So some people say that they just couldn't cross the river because the river is too swollen, so he just came back to Baltimore. But we don't really quite know. There's some unaccounted for days. So we know, we pick up the story 5 days after he left Richmond. He's still in Baltimore, semi-conscious, dressed in somebody else's clothes at a polling place on election day. From there, he was asking if he knew anybody who could help him, and he asked for Snodgrass, who was a magazine editor who took him to a hospital. And Poe spent his last 4 days delirious, in and out of consciousness, talking to shadows on the wall, not making any sense, screamed the name Reynolds over and over again. We don't know who Reynolds was. There's different theories about that. He just kept saying, I have a wife back in Richmond. I have to get back to my wife. And he died 10 days before he could marry Elmira. And back then, you know, you didn't have television, radio. You found out things from the newspaper. So about 2 days later, Elmira read his obituary and found out that he died.
It's awful.
Meanwhile, way back up north in the Bronx, Poe's mother-in-law was still living. She's a widow. And Poe had a big tortoiseshell cat named Katerina, who used to sit on his shoulder while he wrote. She was just devoted to old Edgar. One day, Katerina suddenly died, and that was the day that Mariah, his mother-in-law, found out that Poe had also died the same day.
So how many times has Poe been buried? And there are even some supernatural powers that are reported to be associated with pieces of his wooden coffin. Can you tell us about that?
Well, Poe was originally buried in a Poe family plot. His cousins just put him down in a nice little coffin. It's supposed to be a mahogany coffin. It's kind of hard to tell now, but it was just the day after he died. Quickie ceremony. About seven people were there, including old Snodgrass. Then people started coming to the cemetery. The grave was unmarked, but they kept coming there to see where Edgar Poe was buried. They all wanted to see where he's buried. They wanted to make their pilgrimage to see Poe's grave. The sexton of the cemetery started taking people back, so yep, that's where I buried him. Before long, he just sort of put a little stone there. Not a huge stone, but a little stone, just so he'd remember exactly where he put Poe's body. Then 26 years later, enough people were interested in Poe, and they wanted to memorialize his grave, and they thought, it's a shame he's an unmarked grave. He's the best poet. We need to get him something worthy of him. So they had a nice big monument with Poe's face on the front. It was too big for this little plot back there, so they had some other bodies moved out of the way so they could move him to the front of the cemetery, right next to the sidewalk, to a place of honor. So they had him dug up. And just as Poe's coffin was lifted up out of the hole, the front fell off of it. It fell apart, and people got to see Poe one last time. They said he was mostly just bones. All the clothes and the skin had rotted away, the bones that were sort of falling apart. They looked nice, but the rib cage had fallen open. The mandible had fallen off. He had little teeth resting around his skull. But the newspaper said it had very nice teeth.
Oh,
so that's good. And they scooped up the Poe pieces and put them in a new Poe box and put them in a new spot. Shortly after that, they moved him to the permanent spot under the new monument. But people saved chunks of the coffin as souvenirs, and some were made into pins. The Poe Museum just got a big chunk of the coffin. It's a pretty nice piece that's still a big rectangle. Among the pins, another is one down in North Carolina I'd heard about. There's another in the Enoch Pratt Free Library in Baltimore. So there's a few out there. And there's a story that one of them was given to a fellow named George Hazelton. It'd be given to him by a woman who was a journalist, and she'd had this specially made. And Hazelton was working on a new book about Poe called The Raven. He'd already done a play about Poe called The Raven, so now he's going to do a novel about Poe called The Raven. He wasn't very creative with his titles.
Yeah, really.
But according to him, as he was writing, he put the pen to paper. He was going to write chapter one. That makes sense. But he looked at his paper, it just said Aronel. But what is Aronel? It's E-R-O-N-E-L. Aronel, that doesn't make any sense. You know what? I bet you one of the kids or one of the servants was in here and they wrote this on this piece of paper. So this is just a used piece of paper. May I'll just, I get a clean sheet with nothing on it and I'll try again. So he wrote chapter and just, he looked at it and said, Aronel, all over again. So he said, this doesn't make any sense. I mean, are they just writing Aronel on all the pages? I thought I had ink in here. So he dips his pen into some black ink and thinking, well, maybe the problem is I don't have any ink. And
right.
And then he tries to write, it just shoots out this red liquid all over him.
Oh, God.
And he says, that's it. I'm never using this pen again. There's something wrong with this pen. All it wants to do is write Aronel. It's almost like it wants to write for itself. So eventually he put down the pen, gave up on that one. And then he kept showing his friends this Aronel word. And then somebody says, you know, if you hold up a mirror, Aronel is just Lenore backwards. And that's one of the sketchier stories out
right.
there, because he was writing a novel, so he probably just told this story in order to help promote sales of his novel.
Right. Yes, brilliant marketing.
But at least it makes you wonder what would happen if you tried to write with one of those coffin pens. But I kind of like our piece. It's a big old chunk of coffin, so it's easier to imagine. Oh, yeah, this was
part of a
piece of that box. Yeah.
You all have had a lot of really wonderful pieces recently donated to the museum.
Oh, yeah. There's a collector, Susan Jaffe Tain. She's a premier literary collector with a specialty in Poe and Walt Whitman.
Mm-hmm.
And she knew that the museum was turning 100. This April 2022, the museum turned 100 years old. Imagine that. The museum
Crazy.
Was born the same year as Betty White. And not every museum sticks around for 100 years, but here we are, this little museum that's dedicated to a poet, and people are still coming after all these years. There's something about Poe that makes people still want to show up from all over the world. And she decided, you know what? The best way to celebrate this is giving you a gift of some of the jewels of my collection. So one of them was that piece of the Poe coffin. Another one is Poe's gold pocket watch.
Oh, wow.
And it's great because we know when Poe owned it and we know when he had to give it away. He had to give it away in 1843 after he filed for bankruptcy. One of his creditors was a tailor named Albright, and Poe had to give this to help pay off his debts to Albright. And that was 1843. So Poe owned it in 1842 when he was writing a story. And he writes about a watch. He describes the sound of a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
He says it was a low, dull, quick sound, almost like that made by a watch when enveloped in cotton. I knew that sound well. 'Twas the beating of the old man's heart. So imagine him holding this gold pocket watch up to his ear, listening to it. It sounds a little bit like a heartbeat.
That's so cool.
That repeating ticking, and we've got the actual watch. That's what's cool about that. We've also got the engagement ring, a little gold engagement ring that he gave to Elmira Shelton just before he died. If you look really closely inside, it's engraved with the word Edgar. It's not a fancy ring. It's not one of those ones you think of from the time period with a big cluster of precious stones on it. It's very simple. This is a guy who scrimped and saved, sacrificed to get this little ring for her. The same letter he writes to his mother-in-law and says, I've got the ring. He also wrote that the hotel had confiscated his luggage because he hadn't paid his bill.
Oh, no.
So this is somebody, probably his last cent. He had to borrow and pay whatever he had to just come up just enough to get that little ring for Elmira. So we've got that ring there, and that's going to be on display, too. And there's other pieces, letters, manuscripts, a receipt for a printing of The Raven and the Southern Literary Messenger. So his most famous poem, we have a receipt showing that Poe got paid $10 for its printing in the Southern Literary Messenger.
Oh my goodness. Incredible. Oh,
yeah.
Well, how can people find out more about the upcoming centennial celebration and how they can be part of it?
I'll just go to poemuseum.org, and there's a list of events under the events section of the drop-down menu, so you can see what's coming up. Keep checking that out throughout the year, because we're going to have events throughout the year. Since everything's been a little bit turned upside down by COVID, we're going to, instead of trying to do one big event, we're sure going to have a big event for the 100th anniversary, but we're going to spread it out over the course of the year. So there'll be a series of events, unhappy hours each month, culminating with a big final extravaganza, a Poe extravaganza in January for Poe's birthday. Mm-hmm. So just check out the calendar on the website and see all the latest updates. And if you're interested in more information about the individual objects from the collection, check out our YouTube page. We've got a series on our YouTube page, which is just, I think it's just called Poe Museum. But the series is called The Curator's Crypt. Every other week, there's a new installment profiling one of the different artifacts from our collection. I just did one about the engagement ring. Before that, I did one about the manuscript that was found inside of Poe's desk, one of his poems. It never got published until after his death, but just a little quick poem he'd written. And that's another piece that Susan Tain gave us.
Wow.
Little forgotten poem in Poe's handwriting.
What an incredible gifting for her to do that. That's fantastic. And now, you know, they will be at the Poe Museum, part of the permanent collection. I'm so excited for you guys.
Even after all these years that there's still items coming in, you know.
That's awesome. Yeah, there was one little tintype of Poe. The last photograph I ever made of him was a daguerreotype taken about 2 weeks before his death. And the daguerreotype was ruined when somebody tried to clean in the 1890s. They ruined it. Tintype was made about 1856. So it's the earliest copy made of it. This turned up in a private collection up in New England. And of course, Susan Tain was able to buy it. And she gave it to the Poe Museum. So now we get to see this last look at Poe just for his death. You can almost see that compared with the earlier daguerreotypes is just a little bit more weary, a little bit more stooped in his posture.
It's all that mercury.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
Well, this is a fantastic book tonight that we've just sort of done a sneak peek into just a little bit, because there's a lot more that's covered in this book, and we'll definitely have to have you back to delve deeper into it, because Edgar Cayce is brought up in the book, auto-hypnosis, the possibility could Poe have influenced or even written after his death. So there's a lot more to look into. Haunting Poe, His Afterlife in Richmond and Beyond. Thank you, Christopher, so much for being our guest tonight on Spirited History.
Well, thanks for having me.
Folks, again, get the book, Haunting Poe, His Afterlife in Richmond and Beyond. It is fantastic read. We want to thank everyone for journeying through
Spirited History. Have a blessed weekend, everybody.
Good night, everyone.